As I remember, California State Polytechnic College, San Luis Obispo, presents another in a series of interviews with retired distinguished staff members. This one is John Perosi. John, what was your first contact with California Polytechnic School? Where did you hear about it?
Well, I heard about it from my uncle, who had requested a bulletin sent up to me in Ashland, where I lived at that time. He knew that I was interested in mechanics, and he thought this would be the school for me.
And did you come down then or answer the letter?
Yes, I did. I put in my application to the school, and I was accepted, and I came down for this school year of 1909.
What was the standing of the school then? That is, in terms of the level of its students and so on.
Well, the level of the school at that time was the equivalent to a high school.
It was a state technical high school.
A state technical high school. Only we had only 3 years of work, you see, instead of the four.
Mm-hmm. And what were the main divisions of the school, John?
Well, the main divisions at that time were agriculture, household arts for the women, and mechanics for the rest of the students that didn't take agriculture.
And you entered into the mechanics program.
That was right.
And what were the courses that you took, do you recall?
Well, there was about the only one course that we could take, all the mechanics, they took the one course. And of course, in the earlier years, you took the elementary stuff, and then as you progressed the other 3 years, you went up to the higher categories. And everybody had to take forge, carpentry, pattern making, foundry, electricity, and steam engines.
And at that time, welding was something that hadn't been heard of, I guess.
Welding, except hand welding, that is, welding in a forge, the acetylene welding, if that is what you have reference to, hadn't come into being yet.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the number of buildings there were when you came here in 1909.
In 1909, when I came there, there were about 9 or 10 buildings comprised of the three main buildings on top of the hill where the old administration building is now. And of the three buildings, one still remains, which is known as the agricultural building. At that time, it was the household art building. And the third building up on the hill there was a residence for the girls students on the campus.
And the central building was the administration.
The central building was the administration building, and it housed the different classrooms, and the assembly hall, which was on the second floor, served as our gymnasium at that time.
Were there any dormitories then?
The dormitory up on the hill there, which is known as Dual Hall, was just being built at that time. It was built during 1909, but was completed for occupancy in the fall of 1909.
Mm-hmm. And what were the other buildings, generally speaking?
Well, the other buildings, there were three shops on what used to be Pepper Lane. There was the Ford shop and foundry combined, the machine shop, and the carpentry shop. And right where the wing of the present library is situated, there was the creamery building. And then farther up on the hill, where some of the science buildings are now, there was a dairy building, dairy barn. And that comprised about all, the old power plant used to be the auto shop, what used to be the auto shop in comparatively recent years. And that was situated at the north end of the household art building. And the power plant where I attended to that fall was just completed that fall also.
And that would be pretty much east of the swimming pool, is that right?
That's east of the swimming pool, and it's still there yet, as well as the cafeteria, the old cafeteria. That was built in 1909 and 1910.
And that's the one that's the post office now.
That's the one that's the post office, because I remember the freshman class laid the floor of that building.
Mm-hmm. Then in addition to that, there might be some small buildings out around the farm area?
There were a few small buildings, like the poultry plant. They were just small buildings. And the swine unit, which was along the road leading up to, I don't know just what is in there, or the agricultural engineering. No, the agricultural engineering was to the north of that. But east of that is what would probably be the, agricultural engineering, isn't it? The building?
I think that'd be about where it is.
The engineering building?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, real good, John. And about how many students were there your first year here?
My first year there was about 175 students, which increased to 190 by graduation time.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 25 in my graduating class.
Mm-hmm. And that was about the peak enrollment up to that time?
That was the peak enrollment up to that time.
Mm-hmm. And you graduated in 1912 and went to work for Cal Poly then?
I went to work as a laboratory assistant there in the steam laboratory and engineering and the electrical engineering laboratory. And then in 1914, I spent a year at the University of California at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. And then you came back to Cal Poly?
Then I came back to Cal Poly as an engineer at that time, and then continued on until my retirement of 1957.
And that's a continuous service of 42 years plus 2 years earlier is 44 years.
That is right.
Well, that certainly makes you just about the longest in service of anybody that ever worked for Cal Poly. Now, John, you were here during a number of administrations and so on. The school maintained itself. It didn't grow very much. Were there any particular changes? There were some new buildings that came in the 20s, though.
Yes, there were some new buildings that came in to the 20s. And there was two buildings built, the horse barn and the swine unit was built in there, as well as an auto shop, which took the place of the old Ford shop on Pepper Lane. And then shortly after that, the air conditioning building now was the electrical engineering building, very close to the old power plant.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I recall it, some of the buildings were contracted out, some of them built by local contractors, and some of your responsibility was a few of the buildings or supervising the construction, is that right?
Yes, for 3 years, about 1924 to 1928, I was superintendent of construction when some of those buildings were being constructed.
Mm-hmm. And then when Dr. Crandall became president, he shortly was able to get some new dormitories, is that right?
Yes, there was some new dormitories being built, Heron Hall and Jefferson Hall and Chase Hall and the president's home were all built at about the same time.
Mm-hmm. And the gymnasium was built.
The Crandall Gymnasium was built also at that time.
Mm-hmm. And there were some buildings for faculty members on the campus. I think you told me they were at one place and then they were moved. Now, what were those buildings?
Well, those buildings, the three present buildings that are just south of Dual Hall, originally were on Pepper Lane, right where the Agricultural Engineering Building is. That is the Agricultural Mechanic Building. There were three of them built. In fact, one of the builders of the of those three buildings was Ted Maynell's grandfather.
Mm-hmm. And then they were moved over there to their present location.
They were moved over to the present location there.
And you started living there and lived there until the time of your retirement?
I lived in there in 1918. That was the year I was married. And I lived there continuously up until 1957 when I retired.
Mm-hmm. And during the latter part or after a few years, you had some neighbors there, and you were neighbors with those for a long time. Who were those?
Well, the first neighbor that I had there was Colonel Ryder, who was at that time the president of the school. And then Dr. Crandall came in there. Just before they built his home up on the hill.
And who moved in there when he moved out, John? Was it McFarland?
Yes, I believe it was McFarland. Huh? I'm a little bit slow on the trigger to remember back that far, you see. McFarland moved in there.
Mm-hmm. And then about 1929, you had another neighbor that was there for quite a while. Who was that?
Meacham was in there. Up there in the upper cottage there. And then after Meacham moved out, it was the BOQ for the naval officers that were there during the naval program.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, John, became head of heat, light, and power, superintendent of those, and during the period of your service, which was a very long time, you saw the institution grow from a very small campus to one of tremendous size, and it was your responsibility to see to it that the all of the services that go with what would be a small city were put in. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. We were self-contained. We had our own water system. We had our own sewer system. And we had our own electrical system. And we generated electricity in our own power plant there, being one of the only schools at that time that had an individual power plant.
Mm-hmm. And then as the college grew, it was impossible for the institution to supply all those things, so you gradually went over to the use of utilities taken from some other source.
Yes, that's right, because we used to shut down at 10 o'clock at night, and then from then on, why, you had to drag out the oil lamp if you had one. Some of the places had some gas, but then we ran afoul of the state housing law, and we had to provide all 24-hour service, especially at night. So then we hooked in with Midland Counties, which was the forerunner of Pacific Gas and Electric in this county. So we had a double-throw switch. When we shut down our own plant engine at 10 o'clock, we merely threw the switch over for the dormitory circuits only.
Mm-hmm. Over those years, of course, the all the water lines and electric lines extended to many, many miles and so on. And I recall during years, maybe 10 years before your retirement, that people, particularly in maintenance and operation, began to get kind of fidgety because it was kind of common talk that the only person that knew where all these underground lines were and so on was John Perosi. Now, you got a different story about that. Now you tell me what actually happened.
Well, I was probably the only person that knew where they were. But that didn't stop me from putting them down on paper. So I had some blueprints, kept them up to date, so that no matter who came in after I left, where I simply had to refer to those blueprints to find the locations of the utilities.
Well, isn't this a fact, John, that those blueprints and the locations are so firmly fixed in your mind that if something happened and somebody wanted to know something, you could just go out there and you could say, dig here, and what they were looking for was there. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that is true, because I knew from working with them and installing them and everything else, I knew just where they were from the locations of the buildings that were there at that time. Which, of course, at the present time, all those old buildings are gone, and I couldn't no more go out there and find a main line than I could fly.
And the time you left, everything was there in good order and on blueprints so that anybody could find anything they wanted.
It was on blueprints because when the contractors were on the job, I went out in the field and made my own measurements and everything else so I could place them on my blueprints at the proper location, because the contractor will not always build exactly according to specifications. Sometimes it's a change order that comes along to move a line a few feet or maybe a little farther than that. But I went right out in the field before the lines were covered up and took measurements, placed them on my own tracings and blueprints.
Mm-hmm. Now, you told me a real good story about little trouble with a pump up there about where the slaughterhouse is now, and hear a little discussion about that. What was that, John?
Well, that concerned a pump that we had in a well there, which was with two other springs on the hill back of the, right about where the pea is located, was our sole support, source of water. So in my daily routine work and checking the pumps and one thing and another, one day I found what we called a frozen bearing. That is, that's what we speak of when a bearing is seizes due to lack of lubrication or misalignment. So then when I got back to the boiler plant, I reported to the instructor in charge, who was also the head of the mechanics department. I said, we've got a frozen bearing on the pump shaft in the well up the canyon. And he said, you don't mean to tell me that we've got, that there is ice in that well at this time of the year.
Now there's another story too that goes around here, and I'll ask you about it. It seems that you had some duties that took you up on a high ladder and up on the tall smokestack that came up from the power plant, and something happened. Now, what was that, John?
Well, we had a 60-foot stack in back of the boiler room that needed painting very badly. So one morning I came out early to get there before the wind started blowing, you see, to create a problem with the ladder. And we had a 40-foot extension ladder, which I placed on the stack, and was very careful to place it centrally and so on and so forth on the level that there was a minimize the possibility of slippage. So I was painting away there, and all of a sudden a gust of wind came up in the courtyard between the power plant and the engineering building, and I realized right away what was going to happen. So I started scrambling down off the ladder to get as far down before the ladder would slip either one way or the other. Unfortunately, I didn't get down but about 5 or 6 feet, and the ladder let me down.
And did you get a broken leg?
Yes, I got a broken leg out of it. I landed on a pile of old pipe fittings that were in back of the plant, and I tried to miss them because I knew they were there, but I managed to fall on the ladder, but in the process of falling on the ladder, why, I broke the ladder and I broke my leg also.
And you were there for a little while before you could get out, anybody could get to you, is that right?
Yes. Oh, not very long, because when I woke up, evidently I didn't remember anything about hitting the ground at all. And when I came to, I looked up, and the first person I saw staring me in the face was Jim Marston. And I said to Jim, "What am I doing down here?" I says, "I was up on the ladder there." Well, he says, "Take it easy, take it easy." Says, "You've evidently broken a leg." And here I was scrambling, trying to get up.
Well, it's a good thing that you got over it, because I know that you led a very active life since then, so I guess that it healed all right. Is that
it
right?
It did. It did a very good job on me.
Never done any more.
Never bothered
any
me a bit or anything else at all. It did a very good job.
Real good. Now, John, you had a hobby in the early days that extended over a considerable period of time that you've talked about and which people remembered you for. What was that?
Well, my hobby, of course, was any outdoor sport that took me out in the open, such as hunting and fishing. And I would say probably my main hobby was shooting with a military rifle on a target range.
And you competed in contests and some in national scope and so on?
Yes, I did. For several years, I went back to Camp Perry, Ohio, where the national matches were held each year. And each state in the union was eligible to send a civilian team. A team made up of civilian people entirely. No connection with the military whatsoever. So I was back there 7 or 8 different years. 1 year I was team captain. And the primary purpose of sending civilians there to the national matches was to get the average civilian acquainted with the use of the military rifle and to act as an instructor in case of an emergency.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly tied in with another hobby, which was deer hunting, and I know that you hunted for a good many years.
Yes, I did. I hunted ever since, I guess, I was able to get around the hills with a rifle.
And the availability of hunting has changed some since then?
Yes, it has, a good deal. It's getting so that unless you know someone personally, it's pretty hard to get on private property. The national forests are still public property, and you can still hunt there, but the national forests are getting so overrun with people that really don't belong in the hills with a rifle. Whenever I see a red hat in the hills, I get as far from that red hat as I can.
They shoot at anything that moves, is that
right?
That's
right, that's right. And I've seen it happen. And I've actually been shot at once, and fortunately nothing happened, but I wasn't hit, but that's the reason that I shy away from a red hat.
John, there's another story that just occurs to me. It has to do with you and a sleeping bag. It seems to me like you woke up one cold morning out in a hunting expedition and found a small companion in your sleeping bag. Is that right? Something with rattles on it?
Well, it wasn't quite in the sleeping bag, but it was right underneath the edge of it, you see.
And that was a rattlesnake?
That was a small rattlesnake.
And he was looking for some place to get warm.
Well, I suppose he was.
I imagine
good thing I had a good zipper on there. I was zipped up, and the wind was blowing that morning. It was really cold. But he got under the edge and was a little bit warmer there.
I trust that he went away after you zipped up.
Well,
right?
We took care of him. We took care of him.
I know that you've always had a great interest in sports, other sports too, and watching them and so on. Football, baseball.
Oh, yes. I like all the sports that way. And on the coast here, I've been practically commuting the last few years of my retirement here, up and down the coast between San Francisco and Los Angeles to watch the baseball games.
I imagine big league baseball coming to the coast was quite a thing.
Yes, it was. You bet your life, it was quite a thing. And in connection with the athletics there at Poly, I haven't missed a homecoming since 1912.
Well, that's a very, very long time and a very great record. And there's a homecoming coming up here pretty quick.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. And I'll be there.
Mm-hmm. And when you can't go, you are interested in watching sports on television.
Oh, yes. That fills in a lot of the time for me, because time gets a little bit heavy on my hands. But you'll be surprised how much work that there is to do around the home and around the yard. And when I run out of that, why, I'll hop a plane and go visit with my children and grandchildren.
Was flying an experience that you took up after your retirement, or had you flown before?
No. Yes, I had flown before. One year, my son-in-law and daughter went through here being transferred from an air base up in Washington to Montgomery, Alabama. And they had two cars, and I drove one of the cars to Montgomery. But after going through that desert in Arizona and western Texas and so on and so forth, I didn't want any part of it coming back on a train, because that's how I'd have to come back. So I thought, well, here goes. I hopped a plane, and I come back, and I've been flying ever since.
It's a great experience. And
it is.
Certainly
it is.
The only way to travel distances.
That is, for one. When a person is alone, you see one person, why, the quickest and even the cheapest way is to hop a plane and fly.
John, you lived in one part of campus, and a little ways away, President McPhee lived in the president's home up there, but you had daughters that were about the same age, and they were just constant companions, isn't that right?
Yes, Judy and Marlene, my youngest daughter, were practically inseparable. And, of course, they were all over the campus, and sometimes at noontime, they weren't home for lunch. Mrs. McPhee would call up Mr. McPhee and see if Judy was up there, and my wife would call me and see if Marlene was at the plant, and they weren't. So we'd come home, and he'd get in one car, his car, and I'd get in my car, and scout around the campus looking for the two kitties. And generally, why, wherever we found a dog, I had an English setter by the name of Rags, and he was a good old faithful dog, and I used to use him a lot in my quail hunting. And wherever we'd see that dog, why, the two kitties were bound to be very close. And that's what we'd look for, is the dog, you
mm-hmm,
see.
Mm-hmm. Now, you retired before the compulsory retirement age, and I'm sure you had a reason for that. John, what was it?
Yes, I was only 65 when I retired, and the reason I retired at that early age, comparatively speaking, was I thought I had a few years left in me yet, and I wanted to enjoy my retirement. And then at that time, Mr. McPhee wanted me to stay on until compulsory retirement. He says, you've got a lot of good years left in you yet. I said, well, I think I'll pull out. Well, he says, I'll bet you'll be back inside of 6 months' time. And I said to Mr. McPhee, I says, you want to make a little bet on that? Well, he kind of hemmed and hawed a little bit, and so we didn't make the bet, but I saw him shortly after it, about a few months after that. He says, well, he says, you stuck to your word all right. You didn't come back.
Well, you've certainly made good use of your retirement years, John, and as I look at you now, I think you've got a lot of years left to enjoy sports and hobbies and all this sort of thing.
Well, ever since my retirement, I've had a regular ball. I said, like you say, between all the sports and visiting with my children all over the United States and Canada, why, I've had a regular ball.
Well, that's just wonderful. Well, John, it's been a real pleasure sitting here in your fine home and seeing the lovely yard that you have here. And I might say that John's home is as neat as a pin. Any housewife would just be envious of having a fellow like this to take care of his home. I've been very happy to have had the chance to talk to you. You're one of the first people I got acquainted with when I came here in 1931, and I wish you many more years of happy retirement.
Well, thank you, George. It's been my pleasure.
This program in the series, As I Remember, the interview has been conducted by George P. Cooper.